Thank you.
Co-chair of the Women and the Economy Commission, going to call a meeting to order. And our first order of business, I think, is because we've even got a quorum. And then the legislator asking you on the phone. So yes, we do have a quorum. I'd like to take a motion to adopt the minutes of. Do we have a copy of the minutes? So did you send those to us?
I did not.
Okay. Well, then, let's go ahead and defer that to next month.
Okay.
We usually have, Gail has usually done those too. If you'll send those to us in the future so that we have them along with the agenda, that'd be great.
Okay.
Yeah, super. Appreciate that. Thank you. We'll defer that to next month. All righty. Before we get started with our subcommittee updates, what I'd like to do is invite Representative Angela Romero and Stephanie Fisher to come up to the bias here, and they're going to present some information about a paid family leave proposal that Representative Romero is working on. It is a study item that she will be presenting next week at the Interim Economic Development Workforce Services Committee, and we wanted to give her an opportunity to share what she is proposing, some of the study items that they're looking at related to that, and give us an opportunity to provide her feedback as she gets ready to present that in front of the legislature by providing critical oversight there and some feedback. So please, Representative Romero and Stephanie.
Could we pass on the handout for everyone? I'll give a little bit of background for the commission members. My name is Angela Romero, and I serve on Utah House of Representatives, and I represent House 26. Last year, I ran HB 188, Paid Family Leave, and Senator Escamilla was my Senate sponsor, and hopefully she'll be my Senate sponsor again when I run this bill again this session. And it was referred to a committee, and I'm blanking right now, it was labor. It was business and labor. And there were a lot of questions regarding what this bill would do. And I asked if it could be referred to Workforce Services and Economic Development because we've been kind of looking at these issues, and they agreed to do that. And so it was placed on the interim calendar. So right now I've been working with our staff on the Workforce Services and Economic Development Standing Committee. And I'll just review a little bit of the bill that we tried to run last year. And there were some questions, and I brought Stephanie with me so she can answer some of those legal questions. But basically what the bill would do was it would provide 6 weeks of paid parental leave for state employees. Representative Miller ran this bill the year before I did, and he didn't include universities. And so the cost, the guesstimate, was a lot lower, and then we added universities to that, and the cost like doubled, tripled. And so that's something we're working on right now, which I think there's a lot of misunderstanding on what that cost would actually be. But one of the reasons why I chose to run this bill and I've been working with Stephanie and her organization is because I think it's valuable that we support our state employees. And I've heard from many government employees that when they choose to have a family, if they have to take up MLA and that doesn't provide pay, and they have to use their personal leave. And so for me, to maintain a healthy workforce and to support these families, I thought paid parental leave would be a great opportunity. We are the only industrial nation that doesn't offer some kind of mandatory maternity leave. And that's kind of disheartening for me. So why paid parental leave? You'll see this handout. Too many workers cannot afford to take unpaid leave because of the loss of income it entails, or they have to cut their leave short because of financial or workplace pressures. And what you'll see and what Stephanie will discuss is that when companies or organizations or governmental agencies offer paid parental leave, we actually benefit. the deficit that many people say will incur doesn't necessarily happen. And I'm going to turn the time over to her so she can go into some detail about that.
Introduce yourself. Sure. My name is Stephanie Fisher, and I am here on behalf of the Utah Women's Coalition. We're really grateful to Angela for running this bill for us. She's correct that 2 years ago, Representative Miller did run it. Representative Chalmers, I believe you were in the committee that heard it. I don't know if you recall. But I don't know what you're feeling, but I feel like both times that she's been heard in committee, it's been pretty favorably received, probably more than I was expecting. And there's just been a lot of confusion surrounding the fiscal and the economic impact analysis. So one thing that we're working on in our coalition is helping to increase understanding of what the fiscal and the economic impact notes mean, so that by the time we get to a committee hearing, that confusion, we've already kind of bypassed that confusion, and we can talk about the actual merits of the bill. So, the way that the fiscal note is, this bill actually has, I think, $7,000 fiscal impact note, and the reason that is the way it is there's no additional cost to paying these employees. These employees are already on payroll, and they already receive an income, so we're not expending any new resources or money to pay for them, but what we do see is a high economic impact note, and that's the cost of not having them in their chair, basically, while they're taking the leave. So the $7,000 is associated with updating the payroll accounts, and it's the economic impact note that is what we're really talking about. And that's calculated, so last year it was calculated based on the number of executive agency state employees who had a child that they signed up for PEHP, which is the state insurance plan, and then they calculated the cost for the 6 weeks, presumably that they would be gone.
That's correct. Yeah. And it's really hard to estimate that because we can't predict when people choose to have children. And so that's... And yeah, that's fantastic. And so that could change, that could fluctuate from time to time, but that's why that is one of the main reasons we wanted to research it during interim is we did receive positive feedback, but the question that kind of hangs over this bill is, well, how much is it going to cost? And it's really hard to predict, and we've researched from different states and from different municipalities that have put it together. And, something I got the other day, and she basically was just giving facts about the benefits for some of these individual states, and I wanted her to kind of go over that with the committee, and then we'll open up for questions.
Sure. So there's only three states that have implemented a paid parental or paid family leave policy, and they are very liberal states, which I know our legislature maybe doesn't take, they're not as open to policies that come from these states, but we get some very interesting data points from the states that have passed this. So a vast majority of employers in California, for example, have reported they've reported little to no noticeable effects in terms of their profitability. The vast majority of these employers did not have to hire any new employees to take over a shift. Instead, they just shifted the workplace responsibilities around among employees who are already in the workforce. So there's also some really interesting statistics about individuals and their likelihood of receiving public assistance. And we found for New Jersey that women who take paid leave are 39% less likely to receive public assistance and 40% less likely to receive food stamps when they're following a child for when they do paid leave. So there's also some monetary benefits to the state as well for implementing this type of leave. We're only looking at executive agency state employees right now. It's a subsector or a subsection of state employees, and the reason for that is we think it might be beneficial to kind of test it on a smaller population of the state employees, and then assuming everything works and it runs well, then maybe look at potentially expanding that. But for now, it's just a small subsection of state employees. So it's a very unique solution for Utah. Whereas the other states that have data points that we can look at, they actually mandate paid leave on the private sector. And again, we're just looking at government employees here and just a small population of that.
And just to conclude, paid parental leave is good for the bottom line because it increases worker retention and reduces turnover. And I hear this quite a bit from a lot of individuals that would have to take leave when they're going to have a child, and sometimes they just can't afford it. And then sometimes someone has to stay home because, and so six businesses significant costs associated with replacing employees, and we're only focusing on government here, but what we've found and what we've seen through the research is that individual divisions or departments where these individuals work, everyone will kind of take a load of that work, and then you're not having to retrain someone, and that person comes back to work happy. It helps retain, as I said, the expertise, skills, and knowledge of valued employees, and it means healthier and happier employees. We know we lose a lot of employees to the private sector, and I think this is an incentive that employees could work towards. Is, you know, I might not get paid what I get paid in the private sector, but my employer, the state of Utah, is willing to support me and support my family efforts, and I'm going to give them 110% versus 80% while I have to go to this job. And then it increases worker productivity and company loyalty, as I just discussed, and it assists the state in becoming a more competitive employer. And at the end of the day, we want to see our state employees do the best that they can. And sometimes that's hard to do if you're stressed about whether you're going to make ends meet. And so I think overall this is something moving forward we'll be seeing other states doing. So it would be nice, since we are a family-friendly state, to be one of those states to lead the way.
Yeah, so FMLA is addressed in the language of the statute, but basically any paid leave taken under this would run concurrent with FMLA. So under the federal law, you get 3 months of unpaid job protected leave, and this would just run concurrently with that.
Okay. And we're just asking for 6 weeks. We were looking at it and researching other places, and as you'll see, I can't remember the recent municipalities back east. They did the 6 weeks, and San Francisco has done 6 weeks, and so you're seeing that consistent across the board with municipalities that are going this route.
And have you had any questions or confusion about where it lies within FMLA? And have you heard, am I the
No, you're not. No. You're not the only one to ask. I think people are inherently curious about the relationship with FMLA. I think we're still interested in understanding that now so that we can make sure we prepare a fair presentation so that we can make sure the bulk of the confusion does lie on the economic and the fiscal impact of.
And that's what we wanted to present to the Commission, to address any concerns you have, particularly the concerns that some of my colleagues on our standing committee will have as well. And so maybe what we'll do is we'll have that sheet that describes FMLA and what that entails. And go from there. Because people can right now, if they do FMLA, they can take personal leave or vacation, but that doesn't cover everything. And then when you're sick, where's that leave?
My button didn't work. That's okay. You got the first time it hasn't. You were on original. There you go. I was down there, but I thought I can't. Keep you know, they were up around the shorts already. Okay. Commissioner Marnette.
Thank you, and thank you for the presentation. It's been a while since I've had to think about these kind of things, but I have a question. So when you have a child under PEHP, okay, let's just talk about them because I'm sure every health care is different. You know, when I had a child, they called it maternity leave, okay, or when they billed the insurance company, it was maternity, but now it's not. It's under major medical, and then if you've had surgery or you've had a child, I thought that under your health care or the state insurance, you could have a certain amount of time off paid. So do you know what I'm trying to say is if you have a baby, you get maybe a week off paid because it's considered under major medical. Is there a clause that says your maternity? I thought they took that out years ago. Do you know?
So my understanding of the state benefits that is offered currently is you can take sick leave
for, and the official leave, I believe, for a new child.
Okay, well, we don't want to go vacation, because that's not fair. Yeah. You need a vacation, as you had a child.
And so, like, even with sick leave, too, I think you know, if you think about your sick leave and have a child, and then your kid gets sick during the middle of the year, you don't know.
But if you have surgery, okay, you have major, I thought having a child is under the umbrella of major medical.
And to do that, that is a great question, and I am going to contact and reach out to PHP so in case that question, in case you can ask that question, and I'll send it to the chair of the commissions we send out to all the members.
That's a good question, yeah. You were just wondering.
Hmm.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Madam Co-Chair. This is effective.
Our buttons aren't working, Anne.
Okay. I bet you can hear me without it.
But it's supposed to be recorded. That's the challenge. It's supposed to be recorded. It helps for the minutes as well, I think.
So I'm just going to speak. I'm not sure it needs to be recorded, and we'll all remember. Could you please talk again about the fiscal impact and economic impact of this bill? You made a distinction between fiscal and economic. That wasn't clear to me. And could you just repeat what you said and so that we're sure that we understand how you've approached this?
Yes. So the fiscal note is... Is my mic on? The fiscal note is calculated by the fiscal analyst, and they also prepare an economic impact note. So the fiscal note,
The fiscal note details or addresses actual costs for the state, monetary costs for providing this benefit. And the reason the fiscal note is so low is because these employees are already receiving a salary. So we're not requiring any new money to be put into this program because the employees are already being paid.
Right.
What we do look at, though, is the economic impact of not having the employee in the chair, in her chair, while she's pushing the leave. And so that's a different number. That's not new money that is being put into the program, but it is a measurable resource that will have to be reallocated. And so the economic impact for this past year, Angela, do you have your own? It was high. It was, I think, $1.5 million.
I think it was a little higher than that. I will look to that and send it to the commission. And I don't know why I thought I printed it out, but I didn't bring it with me, and I don't have my computer on me. But the original bill, or the bill that Representative Miller presented versus the bill that I presented last session, there was a big discrepancy there. And so that's something we can do with the fiscal analyst office, so that when we prepare for our meeting, our presentation on Wednesday, we can maybe have them explain that so that it's clear and cut. So not only explain what FMLA is and if PHP covers any part of maternity, but distinguishing between the economic impact and the fiscal impact.
Yeah,
this is important information because the fiscal note is actually quite low, but we're really looking at a much broader impact of people not being in the workforce for 6 weeks. And so the increase for the economic impact, that $1.5 million figure, does that take into account the addition of university employees, or will that boost that even more?
No.
Sorry. Yeah, so the impact from last year included university employees. The impact from Representative Miller's bill did not, and so that's the distinction. And so that's the conversation we need to have. And I know the 78 organization are looking at not including university employees, and we're still, that's why this is an interim study bill. And so before we put all the language in, I'd like to review both just executive branch and if we added universities to that, what that would look like, and explain that economic impact as well as the fiscal note, and really just kind of talk about the basic terminology. I mean, last year when I was writing this, I thought, I got this, and I was learning a lot of stuff along the way, and I'm still learning.
I think another thing that's interesting about this is that, I don't know, I haven't seen the bill for this year, so I don't know how it's written, But for FMLA, generally, you need, there needs to be an eligibility for FMLA based upon length of service. And I don't know whether that's a part of this bill, because if it isn't, then an entirely new pool of state employees would be eligible for 6 weeks of leave. So the economic impact could be higher, I think. And the bill from last year did follow the guidelines of the FMLA, and so you had to work for a certain amount of hours in order to qualify.
Okay. You have to work 30 hours a week, and you have to be employed for a year before you can be eligible.
So it follows the
And what actually, you know, the bill last year is hopefully when we discuss it in committee, there'll be some language from that, and we might change some too. And so what I can do is send all of that to the commission, and if you want to provide me some feedback prior to Wednesday, that would be great. And I'm taking all your ideas that you've presented here, and we'll sit down with our committee staffer and go over that so that we're all on the same page and going forward within the committee, because I know I've been only allocated a certain amount of time, and so I want to make sure that I address everything I can prior so that I can kind of educate some of the committee members and then sit down with them maybe after interim and one-on-one and go over any questions they may have. This is very unique and not so unique, and I think it's a matter of sitting down, talking one-on-one to kind of address a lot of questions.
Sure. Everybody has a question. Thank you. So what I'm curious about is when you presented this bill last year, and I'm just looking at your language from last year and realizing, you know, you've got some changes that you're going to be incorporating for this year's bill. What were the concerns? What kinds of comments did you hear? How have you tried to mitigate those concerns in the legislation? As I look online to the MCSL site that talks about paid family leave, there are, of course, they highlight the states that do have paid family leave, Rhode Island, New Jersey, California, and then they've incorporated New York because they're bringing, I guess they just passed it and so it's on its way. And then they have a link to family leave legislation from, I guess, 2014, so not from last year. And there are just like 10 million bills here from each state that did not pass. So what I'm curious about is, what have you learned from your experience from either watching Representative Miller or your experience last year running this bill? What kinds of questions do you anticipate? What are the roadblocks that you've seen in these other pieces of legislation that other states have tried to run? And are you incorporating those? Are you incorporating them? Let me start over. What are the concerns? How are you incorporating them? If you incorporate enough concerns, do you still even have a paid parental leave bill, or is it just so watered down it's nothing? And so is your goal to forge ahead with this as an educational awareness kind of thing?
Well, the biggest concern that I've heard from colleagues is the economic impact and the lack of knowledge, and this was myself included. I didn't really follow Representative Miller's bill on just FMLA and just educating myself on that, and what is personal leave and what is vacation. Every agency, I mean, every state does it a little bit different, and even municipalities and counties kind of do things a little different when it comes to, like, in Salt Lake County, you can share some of your hours with someone if they're sick. I mean, there's different policies even throughout our governmental agencies. But the biggest concern that I had from colleagues was really about the economic impact and how are we going to pay for this. And so that's why I wanted to bring it before the committee, When I talked to our staffer, we were just going to have a broad conversation and then come back in November or October and address any concerns that had been raised by the committee. And that's where I see it as 70 and I as members of the coalition, meeting with individual representatives on the standing committee to address those concerns after this initial presentation. I'm just educating colleagues on what Katie Crank believe is, because many of them will hear it for the first time because it never made it to the floor, and we were limited on how much we were able to present in committee, so I want to be able to provide them with just an overall view of what's going on across the country, and reminding people that we're the only industrial country that doesn't offer any paid maternity leave. And if we're a family-friendly state, as we say we are, then we know many of our families don't have a choice on whether they should be in the workforce. And so I want to provide a picture for everyone of why this is important to our families and why it's important to support our state employees, because I think it's 110%. And so this initial presentation is just going to be introducing the bill and the topic and doing that education, and then coming back before the committee, seeing if it's something they want to do as a committee bill or it's me going forward and addressing the issue. And I don't see myself watering it down. I'm just going to be very assertive and try to educate people as much as I can, and I'll just keep coming back. I mean, we did that with hate crimes, and it took us like 15 years to pass, and so I'm not giving up, and I don't expect anyone else to. That will take this one. I'm no longer here if it doesn't pass. But my goal is for this to pass.
So just as a follow-up, and I think you may have already addressed this with someone else's question, but do you have a metric right now that can show the economic impact? I mean, how are you going to answer that question?
I'm working on that right now, and so I really need to sit down with our staff, and I need to sit down with HR, and I've talked to Debbie about this, and so we need to just really kind of sit down and put that together, and that might not be ready for this coming meeting, but our current standing committee, that it'll be ready for October or November. My first goal is just to do the education part of it and address that, and say, hey, we're looking at the economic impact right now. This is the fiscal impact, but this is the potential economic impact, and this is what other states have done. But maybe this isn't the route we want to go, and this is why, and this is the route I think we should go. But I won't be there, I think, until November. I'm just going to be honest about that.
I can also address that, if I may. So we don't have the new economic impact to note yet for this year. We have the economic impact note from the years prior. But I think in terms of at least our messaging, sorry, I don't mean to interrupt, but are you using fiscal note and economic impact interchangeably?
No.
I mean, so the economic impact note, is the $1.5 million. That's the note that I think generates some concern. And because that's not, I guess that's not listed online with the bill. That's, And just to address your question, Representative, at least from our perspective from the Utah Women's Coalition, I think our messaging really is that there is a cost associated with shifting work responsibilities around and paying someone when they're not in their chair, but the benefit is healthy families and happier workers and retaining skilled employees, and we think that is something worth investing in. And so a lot of it is really messaging, and we've been in touch with representatives from Adobe and eBay and other private sector companies that do offer very generous types of paid parental leave. And we anticipate they will be there once the session begins to speak from the private sector side in terms of the benefits that our companies have received from passing or promoting similar type policies. Thank you.
So my light went out.
Oh,
okay. It was on, and now it's gone. So
I think you're not on the
That's not working.
Hello?
Oh.
I was taking some notes, but I missed the note on the test section of the state employees. Can you just quickly tell me who are going to be included and why you chose that?
Well, when representing Middle Rankinville, it was only executive branch. And last year, we included all state employees, which included universities. Executive agencies, but I think universities, that was my understanding, were included in that. And this year, we talked about maybe just executive agencies, but I want to have this conversation before I define language with our standing committee to get feedback and to see where we're going with that. So it could be one or the other. I'm not there yet. I want to see where we're at, and I also want to talk to some people that assisted me last year from the University of Utah, so I'm just not going to shut people down before I have that conversation.
For someone that doesn't look to check the agencies, we just need to sign a book.
Like the governor's office, okay, the different departments and divisions under
the executive branch. All of those,
okay, all state of Utah, mm-hmm. Like it, so it would be transportation, Department of Transportation, Department of Health.
Okay,
so
and to Representative Edwards address for me.
Okay, super. So I have some feedback that you might want to take into consideration. And again, I know that you have a limited amount of time, but I'm going to defer to the chair of that committee who also sits next to me as chair of the commission. But I'm thinking that it might be prudent if Representative had staff do an overview of definitions, so what the difference is between FMLA, maybe some information related to the amount of weeks, issues related to what that covers, of what we just talked about, the 30 hours plus a week, that the person has to have been employed at least a year, just the basics so people start from that space of understanding who would be included and who would not be included. And then maybe also having someone from official analyst here or there at that meeting to answer any of the fiscal questions once you kind of work those through. I just find sometimes it's good to do, have them just to maybe, how many minutes do you have, Angela?
Looks like I was allocated 15 minutes.
So I think if you were to give them at least 3 to 5 minutes, just to give, this is what it is, this is what it isn't, this is the frame of understanding federal law versus state law. They could review some of the things that Representative Edward was pulling up from NCSO, the difference between some of the various, an overview of the different, yeah, we've got family leave versus paid sick leave. So apparently, just kind of some definitions and maybe even have that as a handout. And it would even be great, maybe this is something you move towards and you do it in October, where you have, I'm a visual learner, sometimes I want to see it. So sometimes I would think a handout that has the comparisons so that they can visualize, this is what full scope paid family leave looks like in a state that has it from state on down. This is where FMLA is, and this is what we're proposing. Because if it's a smaller, narrower scope of population, that might be easier for people to wrap their brains around and say, oh, this isn't as big as you think it is.
I'm just forwarding some of the resources that I've just been looking up.
On NCSL. Yeah.
On NCSL might be helpful.
And our staff is kind of already looking at a little bit, and I can share with the chair prior to our meeting what our staff has put together.
Right. That'd be great.
Because I want to keep this in intervals, and so that's why I wanted to present here, but I also, when I was talking with our staff, our conversation was based on that this would be an introduction, or would it be actually talking about maybe language of abilities to the concept of what paid parental leave is. So I think Representative Chuck, you've you've outlined, a good outline for this first initial meeting, and kind of talk about the substance of the past two bills, and we can put some visual, maybe better, and I would love for our staff to kind of do the terminology and all of that, and maybe that's where we start, and then...
But I think it makes you conscious of where you're going, that it's very finite and not huge, and then they can make a comparison of what FNLA and other paid family looks like, then they don't get overwhelmed of, oh my gosh, she's trying to make everybody do this.
Another thing, I'm sure Senator Wyler can keep on thinking, I'm trying to mandate this in the private sector.
So the clarification on that. And then the other thing you might want to look into, I'm thinking about the challenge that you're having related to knowing what this will look like, because you don't know how many people are going to take advantage of it and how long they'll take advantage of it for. What you may want to consider as an alternative or something you can negotiate with is a pilot. And I'm thinking if we did a pilot maybe with agencies that would be interested in testing this out. So you might have a large agency like DWS, the Department of Health, and maybe a smaller agency, like, I don't know, I'm trying to think of a smaller agency. It's not popping in my head. History, state history. And maybe you can have some comparisons with one state agency that's really huge and one that's smaller that's willing to try it. And then that way, maybe after 3 years, you can document how many parents actually took advantage of it. I find sometimes that we as legislators get a little freaked out about potential something we can't grasp our minds around what it's going to look like. And then after 4 or 5 years, if you look at, 30 people took advantage of this, or 40 people took advantage of this, or if it's a huge agency, 100 people took advantage of it, and then you can quantify how much was spent, then you could grow, then you could make it permanent for all of the agencies. I wouldn't go to that step quite yet, but that might be something you want to keep in your back pocket of a way to negotiate an idea that you can also start to gather data on. And then you could say, well, out of the 30 people that took advantage of it, everybody took a total of 6 weeks, or, you know, half of them took 6 weeks, some of them were back within a month, and then you're dealing with actual numbers. So just something else that I thought might be helpful. We've got a couple more questions that I kind of want to close down.
And I think that's a great idea. As a backup plan, go with the full, what we'd like to do, but also knowing that there are compromises without, as Representative Edwards saying, just watering down the bill where it's not effective. If we know there's resistance going to that pilot project, because the majority of our college that I talk to, they don't have an issue with this. Their concern is the economic impact that we can't wrap our heads around.
And let's see if that commissioner repaints for the question.
Yes, I actually have further thoughts for consideration, so I'm happy to talk with you offline if there's not enough time to address it. But in general, along the lines, very similar to what has been presented in terms of what you might consider, and maybe I don't understand it as an opportunity to do, but a couple of thoughts come to mind, and that's when you do hand out your paper, and maybe you can add a fact that even if you need to, you don't want to necessarily rework this because it's beautiful. But I've seen you having social impacts and economic impacts. And I think if you broke them down, right, so you're talking about the effects on families and the positive impacts that you can have from a societal standpoint, and then you can work the numbers from an economic impact so that when you're talking about the fiscal is how you open up, right, but then you can do the economic impacts and negative impacts and then positive impacts, right, retaining employees. I mean, you talk about profitability, turnover, morale, you can economic impact those at some point, even if it's an estimated range, take your lowest number conservatively, right? When you're talking in that language, that may be easier to sort of absorb. And what that does is that moves you then into that ROI. What is your return on investment? You break it down to just a sheer number. But the social impacts are important, but I think that you need to hit the economic impact. That's almost like the shame on us, right? Like we're trying to address underemployment, but we're creating underemployment, right? Like if we're going to be good government, we're implementing these policies to address our issues and our economic impact to our communities, then we should be implementing our own policies type of a sort of. So I think that track is really good from a private sector practitioner standpoint. We compete with government agencies for the benefits, not the salary, because the salaries aren't comparable, but definitely the benefits, especially for the 401k. So if you talk about this as being a benefit, I think that's a huge even recruitment strategy, right? Especially for the types of people that are going into these jobs. They're not the, so if you look at Google, you might be getting the software engineers that already probably have an income to pay for their college tuition, right? But if you're thinking government workers, sometimes they are sort of these, this middle class that this would have an economic impact on. So maybe you could look at, in terms of your private sector coming in, maybe your teleperformances or your call center or maybe higher than that. I don't know. I don't need to talk that about government employees. I mean, look at those qualifications, so you're comparing apples to apples when you're using that example, because I think that have a stronger economic argument for you. So I have a couple of more. I'll be quiet, and I'll talk to you guys offline if you want. But I just have some more.
And that's why I'm so thankful to the co-chairs for inviting us here today to have this conversation, because the feedback is so valuable, and I'm at a space where I'm thinking this is going to take a little longer, and that's why we wanted to do the test run on and do the introduction to committee members in September, and know that we have a couple of months to work on it, so hopefully the chairs will have me back in November prior to taking a break, so that we have more awareness there.
Is the fiscal note budget neutral, is that a fair thing to say? No.
What do you mean by budget neutral?
Well, because you said, well, we already employed the people, so it doesn't cost us anything. But it's $7,000. I guess I'm confused on.
No, that would have to be appropriated, the $7,000. The fiscal note, I would have to ask for funding for that to be able to, because if any time you have a fiscal note to a bill, if that is not funded, your bill dies. And so that definitely would have to be, that part of it would have to be funded. The economic impact, that is different states have taken different routes, and so that is something, that would be a whole other conversation to have about if we were going to do a pilot project, or if we were going to go just with executive agencies, what kind of route would we take to offset those costs already within our budget?
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. One other piece of information that you probably already have, but you may want to be sure that you have to hand, is the number of state employees that we have. So we don't know how many will take advantage of this, but if someone were to say to you, how many employees are there in the executive branch of Utah state government, would you be able to answer that? And I think that that's probably something that you want to be able to do, because that's your universe, and the sort of lead that you're talking about is available to both mothers and fathers. Is that correct?
Yeah, and I think perhaps along those lines, what we might want to consider looking at is we have numbers of the number of children from executive agencies and employees that signed up to the insurance, to PHP, but we can always go back several years prior and see, because between Representative Miller's bill and Representative Romero's bill, three times the number of children signed up, and that's actually excluding the university, so it's just kind of a funky surge in children that were added between one year and the next, but we can always go back so we can get a broader sense of what those numbers look like, because I think that might be even more telling, is the number of children that were added to the program, because that's where the cost is coming from.
Thank you. Commissioner, do you have any questions? Just a quick one. We both said it together. A childbearing age, how do you see the approach to childbearing? Certainly wouldn't, myself, I wouldn't want to be included in that.
That's my good question.
I need a migraine ambulance. And what is that usually called?
And if we want to include adoption, then that's another conversation.
Yeah, I was going to say, because it could be grandparent caregiving, a grandparent adoption, and a young infant or fostering, we could...
No,
but it's a good point, because now that I think about it...
It's you're making adoptions, right? And so everybody knows that there are...
Yes. Yeah. 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 That's yes, but the... Yeah. So,
because I'm probably a child by everybody's standards. I don't know how to produce another person.
All right. Thank you, Representative Romero, and thank you so much, Fern. Thanks, Commissioners, for your great feedback for Representative Romero. I'm hoping that will help her as we move forward with events next week. What I'd like to do, I've got on our agenda to do our subcommittee reports, and what I'd like to do is just do a quick rundown of the public policy subcommittee and then allow Tracy Gruber to do her presentation on IGP, and then we'll circle back to the other two committees because they have really brief committee reports. But one of the reasons I wanted to bring the public policy subcommittee and give them an opportunity to give us the opportunity to present some information is Senator Escamilla authorized a study, and I wanted to give her an opportunity to share a little bit about what her findings are and what she's looking into doing with the findings that she received. So the public policy subcommittee met in August, on the 18th of August, and one of the things that we did, well, a lot of things we did really tied to some of the work, the follow-up work that this research subcommittee is doing, so I'll wait to make a comment on that. So what I'm going to do right now is I'm going to put a mic on Senator Escamilla and see if she's still there. Are you still there, Liz?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay. Why don't you go ahead and talk a bit about what your study was and what your findings were and what you would like the commission to consider in the auspices of our public policy work.
Thank you. Thanks, Representative Chavez Hoffman, and more thanks to other commissioners. I apologize that I was mistaken, but I wanted to this meeting. We've had a lot of progress on that policy committee as explained by Representative Chavez, and there's two pieces I've been working with. In order to start this, I just maybe a little bit of background, and I apologize, I should have had my textbook to share some of the information, but I'll email it to Shelly. Is it Shelly or Shell?
I'm sorry.
Yeah, so I'll be emailing it to her so she can share with everybody else that in the commission. I requested from the Department of Human Resource Management information, and it was a random question, and now, you know, it's always tricky when we do that, but it was one information regarding the trends in our workforce regarding gender and the salaries and wages within the state of Utah. And I did this about 2 months ago. I was in July. And it took a while, and I believe EHRM put a lot of effort and was very careful on the information they were sharing, trying to be, I guess, accurate with regards to the analysis. And even though it was a very loaded question, they did provide a short analysis of wage according to gender, and it was a report that was was created by a consultant of EHRM. And you know, what it shows is there is a gender gap, and, you know, there's obviously we need to be very specific and maybe a little bit more detail in terms of some of the data components that were used. And also, like I said, I'll share this with everyone, but what I decided to do after having our meeting with the policy committee is that I opened a bill file to do more exploratory work on this issue, and more importantly, to have state agencies within our state government respond to the strategic plan to bring more certainty on the compensation of all employees based on years of experience and education and make sure we are closing the gender gap. So I mean, that's still the drafting, as you know, that will not take place until 2017. That is something that I hear that I'm already addressing and address legislatively, and will obviously be reporting with more information to the committee as we get more data, but I'll definitely be emailing this report that was shared by DHRM to me personally as a request. I don't know if there's any questions at this point, Madam Chair.
So I'll just kind of weigh in a little bit about what part of our discussion was in looking at the analysis. We saw a couple of agencies where there wasn't much of a gender gap. You had people of equal grade and rank in terms of their position, that whether they were male or female were paid similarly or almost exactly the same. And then there were some VIST departments where there was a very large discrepancy between male and female employees with the same title. And so one of the things that we thought about in terms of not, you know, a stick versus a carrot approach is finding ways to acknowledge and amplify agencies that seem to be doing a very good job of providing equitable compensation for their employees regardless of gender. And then utilize that as a frame for developing best practices with your state government. Okay, what is that agency doing right to be able to do this without having to be asked to do it? And then that's more of aligned with what Senator Escamilla was talking about related to putting together a strategic plan for agencies to, within a certain number of years, come up with a gender equity, a gender parity payment or salary plan. And then that way, hopefully, I mean, I'm sure that we'll still get some pushback, but at least it's not starting from a place of, you agencies aren't doing a good job. You know, we want to try to acknowledge where it's being done well and learn from the agencies that seem to be doing, being able to navigate that and to the benefit. And then maybe have them start collecting data on turnover and training of employees. Do they have better retention because of equity? And look at those variables because, you know, in fairness to the agencies, some of these agencies that had a bit more lack of parity, it might have been hard to sample because, for example, in transportation, there was a category that I can't remember what it was, Senator, but something like, you know, transportation workers, something like that, where you could see that the numbers were like 90% men and 10% women. So that we'll have to take those variables into consideration as we look at that. But I also don't want that to be seen as an excuse either. But I think that I'll help us explore, you know, those differences in the job category, skill set, education, all of those types of things, and then make those allowances for gender. Anything else, Senator Escamilla, on that?
Sorry. Yeah. No, I think you gave a different, I mean, that background is important. I mean, to your point in transportation, I'm looking at this, and there's only one female employee, and her salary ranges are the same as her counter with 99% of, you know, other male. But it's just one. I mean, the universe is really small, to your point. So, I mean, in some pieces, in some areas, it may be very hard to compare, but I think at the end, it's kind of the exercise of strategically come with ideas that it's going to be addressing this and making it conscious for the state agencies as they do the hiring, promotion, and retention of their employees. So I, you know, we'll bring more information. So that will be that bill related to their wages and gender. I don't know if you want me to speak on the community health work.
I actually wanted you to, I was noticing in my notes that, yeah, why don't you go ahead and speak to your community worker legislation that you're also planning on proposing this year because it does fit align very well, I think, with the commission's priorities.
Okay, thank you. That's better than, and I'm sorry that I really have a bad signal where I am, which is beyond crazy to think that it's a bad signal, but it is a bad signal here. But anyway, the other one, so I've been working, and this is actually after some conversations with my colleagues in the legislature that are part of the commission, we wanted to address. And I remember bringing some information about postpartum issues related to, you know, postpartum for women. Obviously, one of them is the safety of babies, and I shared with some of you information related to the baby boxes, and we're working on that piece on the side. But also, we've seen a huge increase of postpartum depression and unfortunately, really bad outcomes for women related to postpartum depression in Utah. And there is, I think, a shared interest by all the legislatures that are serving the commission, and I know of other members of the commission, to have more systematic policies, you know, this ideas to address this issue. And one of the things I'm working on in a bill is to pilot a program where a community health worker will be in assisting with mothers that are, you know, early teen mothers or after giving birth in their postpartum process, especially in areas like rural Utah where they may not be a lot of family support or other types of support for these women. And this community health workers will be continually visiting these women, addressing any issue related to postpartum depression or other issues of safety for them and their children, their babies. And it's very successful in other countries, and we're still trying to be more proactive in helping women, so we're drafting out Black People legislation. I don't know if there's any questions that's kind of on this.
I don't see any, but I'm really glad to see. Oh, wait, we have Commissioner Barnett has a question for you. Yes, Commissioner.
Thank you very much. This is going on in Canada, actually. My daughter lived there for 4 years, and it's a great program. I had personal experience with it and mentoring her. Here she is, away from home, no family. And they come into the home a couple of times a day, and I think it's 6 weeks. Really lovely.
Great. So some additional experiences in a number of countries that utilize this, particularly for women postpartum. I know that Senator Escamilla has worked hard to try to establish the idea of community health workers a bit more broadly, but we thought maybe this would be a good starting point to help with postpartum and then also address those, you know, stability of a family and they move forward to that part of that postpartum time and prep mom to get ready to return to work healthy and happy and with what the resources that she needs and the family needs. Any other questions or comments?
So, you know, and just to add to that, and I'm sorry if I can't hear very well, but we know, I mean, this is data, that the number one reason for women to die in the first year of delivering a baby is depression and suicide. So it is a real issue, and coincidentally, the Department of Health in suggesting postpartum depression as one of their medical issues and health care issues that turn out to a public health crisis. So, you know, I'm going to try to work within that framework. Historically, I've been trying to do more work as Representative Chavez mentioned on community health workers to being, you know, to actually make it so more people have access to their quality of life. Many of those are women and children that disproportionately are, you know, poor and may not have access to quality care. And community health workers tend to be a good mechanism to change some, you know, more healthy habits and so forth, educating from neighbor to neighbor type of program. But I, you know, that has been very successful with that model of the legislature. It's a top issue, but so because it requires infrastructure and an investment. So there's a obviously a fiscal note attached to this work. But I think if we focus on women and children, like, you know, postpartum issues and newborn babies and, you know, moms, and we can quantify the return on investment, we could be maybe more successful. That's what we're calling it, a pilot program. And we will be doing a strong focus on rural Utah where the services are very limited. Now, the only thing I can say, because I know Senator Henderson is not in the meeting, she was, I saw her email excusing herself. She is also running some legislation to address the lack of support and infrastructure when you actually are seeking help. And that's another issue. The problem is not only educating women about seeking help and asking for help. The problem is we don't have good infrastructure in the state of Utah, which helps those women that are facing postpartum depression. So that's obviously another policy issue that I know will be addressed. And I'm looking forward to having that conversation, but I think this could be complementary to the whole process.
Super. Thank you so much, Senator Escamilla. Thanks for passing in my thoughts. I really wanted you to talk about these two policy issues that you're working on. And as we get closer to getting those drafts put together, perhaps maybe in our October or November meeting, if you wanted to have the commission take a position on supporting those. We'll be meeting through the first part of the year too, so you could do that at that time also. But did want to bring that to the commission's attention as issues that you're working on, so as you move them forward, we're ready to support and to understand what they're about, and so you don't spend as much time bringing us up to speed as to the direction that you're going. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, ladies.
So I'm going to, there were a couple of other items in the Public Policy Committee that we talked about, and Senator Escamilla talked about one that Senator Henderson is working to run some additional postpartum depression legislation to support providing appropriate care service delivery for women who may need inpatient care. And so I'm looking forward to hearing what her proposal is, and we'll ask her at the next meeting to present on that. And then I also know that, and I'll ask Stephanie to come back next month to talk a little bit about some other ideas they have related to FMLA, to possibly at the state level drop the number of employees within private businesses and all businesses to consider the current 50 employee requirement for FMLA, but maybe down to 30 employees. She and I have had an initial conversation about it, and I do want her to come again and kind of present as to what their proposal is. But as we were talking about this proposal related to FMLA for businesses with fewer employees, we talked about how that might actually impact the issue of intergenerational poverty. And as such, when we started having that conversation, we thought, you know, this might be a good time for the commission to hear an update from the IGP folks. So, because I know they've been doing some incredible work in terms of visiting different communities from throughout the state related to IGP work, and I know that our chair, Elizabeth Edwards, has also been following this work. And so I've invited Tracy Gruber from BWS, who oversees the Intergenerational Poverty Project and the work that they've been doing, to give us an update and let us know what she's been doing over the last few months. It's probably been at least a year since she's come and presented in front of the commission. So more or less just an update. So we've got Ms. Gruber here today. So welcome.
Great. Well, thank you so much for having me. I'm Tracy Gruber with the Department of Workforce Services. I'm the advisor on the Intergenerational Poverty Initiative and the director of the Office of Child Care. So I appreciate the opportunity to come and talk about what's been going on the Intergenerational Poverty Initiative. Really, since the last report, we are preparing to release the next report, which is due at the end of this month. And it will include all of the new data, updating the indicators that have been identified and tracked in the four areas of child well-being that impact families experiencing intergenerational poverty, as well as children who are at risk of remaining in poverty as they become adults. And just as a reminder, those four areas of child well-being are early childhood development, education, health, and family economic stability. So in addition to preparing the report and looking into what all of the commission member agencies have been doing, there has been a lot of locally based activity that the commission has done really since session was over last March. There have been 10 rural counties that were identified as having the largest number of children at risk of remaining in poverty. And once those counties were identified, the commission, through the Department of Workforce Services, developed local-level data, county-level data, around intergenerational poverty to share with those local leaders. There was a very strong belief of the commission that addressing and working to reduce intergenerational poverty cannot be done by the state alone, and it's our local communities that have the capacity and the knowledge about what's going on in their communities that's influencing the conditions of these families best equipped to address the problem or the issue, the challenge. So with the assistance of the Lieutenant Governor, who is now the chair of the Intergenerational Welfare Reform Commission, that is a change since the last time I presented, and John Pierpont, our executive director, they have visited 10 of those rural counties, all 10 of them, presented their local data, and have encouraged them to apply for planning grants to help the communities themselves develop plans that align with the goals that have been adopted by the Intergenerational Welfare Reform Commission in each of those areas of child well-being. So currently they're in the process. They just submitted their grants. They will be awarded probably within the next few weeks. They will be supported by training modules that are being developed by Utah State University Extension to help these counties organize and develop their plans. So what that kind of looks like is that the counties that have requested the funds all have to have stakeholders from each of those areas of child well-being to make sure that the plan that comes from the counties has the input of all of those stakeholders that have influence and are at play in the lives of children and working towards their outcomes. So we've got early childhood development organizations and public health, behavioral health, K-12 education, higher education, workforce development, economic development. So that's really where the bulk of your focus has been since March, I would say. Last legislative session, there were a few pieces of legislation that the commission endorsed, and two of those pieces of legislation were passed. One of them was Senate Bill 101, which expanded high-quality preschool to low-income children and provided scholarships to children, four-year-olds, who experience intergenerational poverty. And the second piece was the Partnerships for Student Success Bill, which creates a community schools collective impact model to help children and their families who are experiencing hardship. And part of their requirement was to align with the 5 and 10 year goals that were established by the commission. So that's really a kind of high level view about what's been going on. I would welcome the opportunity once the report is released to come back and share some data. And where they're going moving forward is now the commission looks at the data and establishes recommendations for their 5 and 10 year plan to further those goals. Over the next several months, as they did last year, they will be inviting legislators who have legislation that aligns or and or advances the goals of the commission to come and present to them and ensure that any policies and programs that are putting forth stay true to the legislative intent of the Intergenerational Poverty Mitigation Act, which is for all of those policies and programs to be data-driven and driven by research. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Do we have any questions from the commission?
If not, I've got time.
I'm here.
Yeah. So a couple of things, Tracy, that I'm thinking about, and it comes on the heels of the presentation that we heard yesterday at the ECHO Education Summit down in UVU that all the legislators that have some touch points related to education were invited to attend the education summit. So if you serve on public ed, higher ed, standing committees, or the appropriations committees, and legislative leadership, they have a full day summit, and they talk about issues related to the infrastructure of schools, what's there in terms of support for the teachers, what's there in terms of workforce development and making sure that young people have the education that they need to be able to go pursue careers that are high-paying jobs. We talked about apprenticeships, we talked about a lot of different things there. We talked about school grading. But the thing that a lot of people who know me know that I care a lot about is this issue of toxic stress and anxious of children who are growing up in environments and in homes where there are high incidences of very traumatic experiences that then precipitate them on a trajectory where they cannot succeed, or they are less likely to succeed because it impacts their brain chemistry. We know science shows us that if a child, an infant, a toddler that is exposed to a certain number of very traumatic experiences before they reach preschool, it is very challenging to get them to succeed. And there's a lot of more intervention that needs to occur in order to make that happen. But some of the things that I'm looking at, Tracy, if you'll kind of explore what was found, I'd like to know what was found as you had those conversations in the several different counties. Is this something that seems to be percolating at a very high incident rate because of perhaps economic downturns in those communities, and then of course that impacts family tension, which then might manifest itself in terms of family violence or lack of appropriate care because, you know, we've got hungry kids and people that just can't make ends meet.
And then the other thing that I wanted to look at, in addition to that, is teenager or early parenthood, and are you monitoring that? And because, to be quite honest with you, you, we can keep these young people from starting families until they're ready to be able to care for the families. I think that also impacts the stressors on that family and therefore the kids, et cetera, et cetera. So I don't know. I know that's a touchy subject to talk about family planning, but to be quite honest with you, I think that if we're talking about intergenerational poverty, that is an indicator, I believe, if I recollect some of the research that we've looked at with you in the past, of if we have multiple generations of early parenthood, that it is harder for those families to break out of that cycle. So if you could just address how that might be manifesting itself in terms of objectives of interventions and preventions.
So I'll take the first one first. There's no question that when you look at the statewide data, we know that these children are, and their parents, have been exposed to adverse childhood experiences. And we did do, well, our research partners at the Social Research Institute looked at our family employment program, which is our cash assistance program, which are the poorest families in Utah who are receiving cash assistance, and they found that the level of ages is much, much, much higher than the average Utah citizen. In fact, if I'm remembering my numbers correctly, 44% of them had between 5 and 8 ages. And if you add anybody who had more than 1 age, with those with 5 and up, it's about 98% of the family employment program population had those adverse childhood experiences of the survey that was done, which wasn't everybody, but it was statistically significant sampling. We also are seeing in the data high levels of exposure to abuse and neglect for children and of their parents. So of the intergenerational poverty parents, 26% of them were victims of abuse and neglect when they were children, and about 24% of the children now have already been victims of a substantiated case of abuse and neglect. So then when you look at some of the other data, and this is all correlated data, we know that toxic stress influences negative outcomes and increases risk of behavior. This is, you know, longitudinally nationally recognized research, not research that was done in Utah. So we are seeing higher rates of interaction with the juvenile justice system of our population. This year we looked at interactions and overlap with corrections of our adult intergenerational poverty population. We looked at rates of substance use disorders and able to access services. And this is kind of a preliminary show of the data that's going to be coming out. I'm sure it's no surprise to everyone who studies these issues and the impacts that toxic stress has and adverse childhood experiences has on long-term outcomes. The rate of use is higher, substance use is higher, the rate of mental illness is higher, and their ability to receive services, of course, is not meeting the need if you purely look at the data. So troubling indicators, and again, correlation, we're seeing really poor negative academic outcomes. And is it toxic stress that's causing these negative outcomes? Is it scarcity, economic scarcity, that's causing these outcomes? Our research doesn't get to causation. It's purely correlation, and it allows policymakers and people in government to utilize the data to see what gaps need to be filled, with maybe not always knowing what the cause is of these situations. So no doubt that when you go out to these rural counties, they are feeling the squeeze of some of these at play. Depending on where you're at, they have different priorities, which is no surprise, which is why it's so important to go to the counties themselves. So some of them are really focused on early childhood. They have no real early childhood going on in their communities, and they know that that needs to be a priority. Some of them are seeing really high rates of substance use disorders with their teen and adult populations, and they feel that that's an important priority to address. And I think that it's really important that they are the ones that are driving what's going on in their community. So I think that there's a lot of that at play. Involvement with the juvenile justice system varies by county to county, and by giving them this data and showing where they are having challenges, we're hopeful that they're going to leverage the commission's goals to address those challenges for their communities.
So just a quick follow-up. So the initiative grants that are going to be moving forward, are you, and I know you're looking at the four areas, but are you also maybe emphasizing what you know works? So we know that early childhood education and support for families that might be dealing with toxic stress situations or just not knowing how to parent and the other stresses, economic stresses, can make a difference. So are you, are the criteria aligning with what we know might make the best difference within those four categories that have been identified by the IGP?
Yes. So the commission is required to look at research and data in order to make recommendations. So as they look at recommendations from this year's report, they will be looking at all of the research and best practices. There's lots of databases out there that have best practice programs that are evidence-based that you can tap into depending on what solutions or what gaps you want to address, and the counties will definitely be supportive in figuring out what those strategies are.
I have much of a question, more of an anecdotal of how I'm involved with Beaver County, one of the identified counties, and I can speak to sort of at the local level. And so what Beaver County has done is really mirrored what the commission statewide has done. And the statewide commission, Tracy, has been up north and already providing that technical assistance to say, okay, we're looking at the indicators that they've identified already, that's the jumping off point, and then what do we see in Weber County specifically because they have countywide data, and then what are the assets, what are some of the early childhood or the family economic stability that we have here, and then we may have some secondary sort of indicators that they're interested in at for Weber County very specifically. So I think it's been a really nice taking what DWS has done, because they've done obviously quite a bit of work, and I think each county, I'm imagining all the rest of the counties are doing something very similar. So they are drilling down and then sort of drilling back up to say, are we doing the right things? And so I think it's a really nice partnership, and I very much appreciate what you've done. So but if you
thanks for the information, showing us how that's manifesting itself in the county. Any other questions or comments?
Thanks, Tracy, for being here. So, you know, at the beginning of IGP, there were some, maybe a series of factors that were considered and recognized as being important in moving families out of poverty. And then the IGP, you kind of focused on a few of them, like three or four, right? I mean, I'm just trying to pull this up right now, like the early pre-K, that was one. What else? What are the, you know what I'm trying to say?
I think so. So there have been indicators that have been identified in each of those areas of child well-being in terms of writing the data report, and this is where it starts to get a little bit confusing. We first started reporting the data that we had within those areas of child well-being. So I don't have a list in front of me, but for early childhood, we're looking at whether or not they're participating in high-quality preschool programs, whether or not they're getting early medical care. I'm trying to think what kindergarten readiness, although that's kind of not, we don't have data on that because there's no statewide kindergarten readiness assessment. And then in education, we're looking at issues like chronic absence rate, enrollment and participation in optional extended day kindergarten, third and eighth grade standardized test proficiency scores, graduation rates. So we do have a set of indicators. Then the commission, who established its 5 and 10 year goals, have identified benchmarks that they're trying to meet. And I could say those benchmarks are currently being revised. It's kind of been an iterative process, and they were in place for a year, and the commission members felt that they needed to be revisited, and they actually tomorrow are going to finalize their updated benchmarks and release an updated 5 and 10 year plan that will also include the recommendations that they're reviewing. So there's indicators that are contained currently in the data report, and then there's some benchmarks that the commission have adopted to make sure that they are moving toward meeting their 5 and 10 year goals. Is that helpful?
Yeah, that is helpful. So there were a couple of things that were indicators that they weren't being dealt with, like, at the beginning piece of this. And they're maybe more part of a longer view of this IGP. And one, I think, was healthcare. Like, you don't have any specific initiatives on healthcare or housing, right? But they were part of your, part of the total package. Do you anticipate moving forward on either of those issues?
Yes. Sisters report has more housing data and kind of started to look at cost burdens of housing and how much, what is the housing burden for families that are experiencing intergenerational poverty. What percentage of them are paying 30% or more towards housing, what percent are paying 50% or more towards housing. So I would anticipate that those issues will be addressed in moving forward. In the area of healthcare, we frequently hear, well, we need to increase the insurance rates, and for children, that's definitely true at the statewide level, but when you're looking at families that are participating in public assistance, which is the lens through which we see all of our data, the rates are extraordinarily high, and where we are having problems is utilization. So they've got the health insurance, they've got the coverage, they're not going to the doctor. And it's incumbent, and what the Department of Health is one of the partners at the table is doing, is trying to figure out how they're going to meet that 5 and 10 year goal, which is increasing utilization throughout the state. And is it a question of there not being access to health care in some of our communities, and that's why they're not utilizing? Are they not utilizing because things, you know, from a day-to-day basis with getting kids to school and off to work, there's challenges with meeting all those other obligations in your family life? We also know that there's influence when parents don't have health care. That influences whether or not children receive health care. And over the past 3 years, the rates of adults who have access to health insurance has gone up. So we're expecting and hoping that the data will soon show that utilization has gone up. And for this year, it has pitched up a little bit.
Okay. So this is a really great teaser about what we're going to hear when the report comes out.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And next month?
At the end of this month. A few short weeks. And I didn't answer your question about family planning. And some people would maybe prefer to overlook that, but I do think that it's important and it warrants attention. I mean, the government alone cannot solve this issue. These are children and families and parents need to be equipped with the knowledge and skills to help support their child's development and academic outcomes. And there is no question that data clearly shows that if you are a child growing up in a single-parent household, you are more likely to live in poverty than if you are growing up in a two-parent household. So about 33% of children growing up in single-parent households are living in poverty, which is much higher than the rate of child poverty in general. So this issue of family formation is definitely at play, and it's definitely something that I think the commission feels that it needs to be looking at and understanding the relationship of family formation when that happens. The teen pregnancy data is for this population, which is not a surprise because we use our teen pregnancy rate super low anyway, and it keeps getting lower. We are not seeing that an overwhelming majority of these individuals had children in their teen years. A lot of them haven't been married, but in terms of the age at which they had children, the teen pregnancy data has just not been an area that's revealed significant challenges. There's much bigger issues than teen pregnancy, and I think that's just a function of our nationally teen pregnancy rates are going down pretty dramatically, and I think we're seeing that in our data as well.
That's a promising thing to hear.
I will quote, though, from the intergenerational poverty report from 2012 that I'm looking at right here. This is just an interesting statistic that says two-thirds of second-generation adults, these are IGT adults, have children of their own. That is, there are currently 50,000 children in the third generation. So this is not, I mean, their maybe teen pregnancy is decreasing, but you're seeing more compressed generations. And you're even seeing one in every 20 intergenerational teen girls age 13, 17, was pregnant during this particular year and expecting the fourth generation of
and I think that at that time when we were looking at that data in the very first iteration, we weren't looking at the standard definition of a teen pregnancy rate. And when you look at the ages of the kids in a standard definition of a teen pregnancy rate and you compare that relative across the board, it's not at that same level. It's not as if they're not having children. They are. I don't want to say it. Communicate that they aren't, but the amount of those intergenerational poverty young women who are having children in their teens is pretty low. And we also started to expand and look at 18 to 21-year-olds, and that's also, it's also pretty low, the percent, and I can't remember off the top of my head, the percent of the youth and, well, young adults in that population that are having children. So it's definitely an issue. It's all kind of where are you going to prioritize the concerns and where we're seeing the biggest gaps.
Along those lines, sorry, I'm too short. Along the lines of the 18 to 21 year olds, and then I know that you guys have started to break down that the 18 to 21 inside of the 18 to 24 year old population as well. But when you're looking at pregnancy rates, are you also able to extrapolate some of the data in terms of single parents, right? So if you have the pregnancy rate, are how many of those are you tracking that have two-parent families, or at least a significant other rate of a two-parent home if it's not sort of legal?
Yeah, so we can look at that data, and again, I don't know the numbers off the top of my head, but it's over 60%, I'll say that. Over 60% of the intergenerational poverty children are growing up in single-parent households. So it's very high.
And how do you guys, so I understand historically speaking, 50,000-foot level, so there's the child centric model, the two-gen approach, sort of initially. Are you still staying along that child-centric model, or are you guys moving to more of sort of the child-centric, obviously, but then with more of the family economic stability? And the two-parter question I have with that is, when does that 17-year-old IGP child then become the adult and no longer sort of the child anymore, but in that next? Right, like they should potentially still be receiving services that you wouldn't want
to. When do they move into the next generation?
Well, that's part of the reason we weren't always looking at the 18 to 21-year-old.
Okay.
Because it's tricky, right? I mean, some are college students and they're living at home there's no clear delineation for when they are now independent and no longer considered a child. We look at ours between 0 to 17 as children, 18 to 21 as its own individual cohort of population that we track, and then 21 to 44. And the oldest people in that cohort changes every year, increases every year because of our data. We don't have data before 1989. So we're always adding a year of adulthood. So the first year it was 21 to 40-year-olds. Now we're up to 21 to 44-year-olds.
But those individuals are not necessarily I guess when I'm thinking about tracking the data,
and I'm not asking how you guys are doing it or how you sort of dealt with it, is when you're looking at intergenerational poverty and when that 18-year-old becomes an adult, you still don't want that 18-year-old to get pregnant, right? Because at 18, they're probably not prepared to have babies. So my question is, when we're looking at interventions as a whole or some of the research foundations and the benchmarks, how do we deal with that sort of 18 to 24 where they're still kind of that youth, right? That's where they maybe are starting to do actual family planning instead of making sure that they don't have a family when they're not ready. How do you guys look at that from a larger perspective of we're still looking at interventions for when we're looking at that person and we're tracking that person, do they fall out of the data at some point? Or are they always looked at, or are we always only looking 0 to 24? Does that make sense?
I think I'm following. I mean, they're never ignored in the data. I think that the research would say if you address early childhood development, that leads to improved outcomes, not guaranteed, improved educational outcomes. Better educational outcomes leads to a reduction in risky behaviors, and graduating from high school is an indicator that you're not going to get pregnant at a young age. So that's kind of, I mean, the idea is that when you involve these interventions, these evidence-based, research-based interventions, throughout the continuum of a child's life, you're going to see reductions in some of that other riskier behavior. You're going to see reductions in substance abuse. You're going to see reductions in interactions with the juvenile justice system. And that, I think, where the research is leading the commission in terms of specific strategies. They had recommendations last year. I expect those recommendations to stay in place, and I think that they're going to build on them going forward. In terms of the whole two-gen, kid-centric, that type of thing, I think by bringing in the area of child well-being, family economic stability, demonstrates that this is about the whole family. We are focused on the kids. The data is reviewed through the lens of the child to see how these issues are impacting the child, but we know children are not growing up by themselves and they're living in families, and that's where the family economic stability comes into play, and employment opportunities, and income, and educational attainment of parents, and access to housing, and food, and all of that.
So essentially, your data, when you're looking at it as a snapshot, your 0 to 18 are sort of these benchmarks, and then your 18 on is almost outcomes.
We're looking at the 18 to 21-year-old indicators in the same way that we're looking at everything else. So we've looked at graduation rates, we've looked at post-secondary enrollments of those kids, we've looked at employment and wages and all of the same indicators. And we haven't gone back in time and said, what were their standardized test scores? But we know whether or not they graduated from high school and whether or not they're participating in post-secondary and if they have employment and how much they're employed throughout the year, so very similar. And based on that data, the idea of the entire effort is not to create new programs, but to look at the data and see where there might be gaps and where efforts need to be better or more successfully targeted.
Any other comments from the commissioners? Tracy, there's one more thing that when we're talking about housing that I'd like to know about is, you know, we're looking about affordability, but I also want to look at the likelihood of affordability, more affordable housing being close to where people are more likely to work. I mean, if people have a high transportation cost because affordable housing is so far away from work centers, or quality schools.
Mm-hmm.
So those types of things, you know, it's a quality of life issue that relates to that housing accessibility and the housing affordability for individuals that are trying to move themselves out of intergenerational poverty. Because I know, in particular with Salt Lake City, we're really, really, really challenged with providing affordable housing for families. I mean, there's housing going up all over the place, but it's above market rate, and people just can't afford it. So it's very frustrating to me that we're building new stuff, but it just isn't affordable. So anyway, something we need to work on. I know that
Chair Edwards has been working on some of that in terms of closely transit-oriented housing and things like that. So the it's sad when people are using that much of their monthly income just to house themselves, and then it makes the other stuff harder to obtain.
And there definitely is a lot of activity going on right now around housing and homelessness and housing affordability and various efforts, and the commissioner is paying very close attention to that and wants to leverage what's going on in those other task forces to make sure that there's alignment and coordination and they don't come out with policies and strategies that are not aligned with those efforts. I mean, that's one of the most critical functions of establishing the Welfare Reform Commission, is that there is an alignment and coordination to address these issues as opposed to continuing to make potentially bifurcated systems.
And just as a closing thought before, I allow my chair, my co-chair, to be asked a couple of questions. It's related to just by point of information, the Multicultural Commission is decided to look at early childhood education as kind of our vanguard issue, because we know a lot of the other issues we've been dealing with, whether it's health or economic development or prevention in the disproportionate number of minorities that are in our correction system, that ECE is probably one of the best things we could be working on. And Lieutenant Governor is also our chair of that commission. So we're trying to find ways to make sure we're all not doing 15 different things, that we're actually working together and dovetailing efforts in terms of what the Multicultural Commission is focusing on with IGP and some of these other efforts. So I'll just keep that in there. Anyway, shoulder. Chair Edwards.
Thank you. This is still sort of a heads up to the commission. You bring up a good point. The Lieutenant Governor is convened an affordable housing task force that's been meeting since May, I think. And I've been serving on this as well, and we're pretty close. Hopefully by the end of this month, we'll have some legislation that a very, very wide range of individuals can agree on. And that we'll be dealing with a pretty broad range of affordable housing, aspects of affordable housing, everything from state low-income housing tax credit to an expansion of a program that we had in the build last year that was a market-based approach. And several other things. I feel extremely optimistic about this. Lieutenant Governor's task is to try and get this fairly big ask into the governor's budget, and he's working on that. I'll be running the legislation, and I am now realizing a critical partner has not been at our table. I knew something was missing, and it is IGP. I'm going to send you an email to loop you into this next meeting in September, so that we're hopefully, if Peter Ashton, our drafting attorney, can get everything put together, we will have at least preliminary piece of legislation at that meeting end of September, I think the 28th. And it would be great to have you as a partner with your eyes at this point of the game, because we're you know how these things work. It's a large group. And so, and Lieutenant Governor Cox at our last meeting said he would like this to be one comprehensive bill to run through without amendments and without danger of being co-opted by whoever as it rolls through. So it'd be really great to get your feedback on the front end of this.
Great. Happy to do it. And I think, you know, it's a great opportunity for the Welfare Reform Commission to help support those initiatives as well.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks.
Do I know any comments or questions? Thank you, Ms. Cooper, for her time and for the update. It was great work moving forward. Looking forward to working together with you on that.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
So I'm going to go ahead and move over to committee reports from the other two committees, our research committee and our communications committee. Commissioner Wallace reports that they are getting very, very close to having that website ready to go and hoping to launch it. So we're just finalizing some last touch-ups on it. And so hopefully by the next commission we'll have that live and running forward. And then Commissioner Robinson reports from the Research Committee, and Commissioner McCoy, feel free to weigh in any additional thoughts on this. But two things are occurring. The focus group research that was funded by the initial grant that we received from the Walmart Foundation is starting underway this month. They are holding 14 focus groups across the state to start gathering that qualitative data, communicating with the women that are a part of the workforce on their experiences in the work world, and looking forward to getting that information to us by the end of the year. And then with our great partners at the YWCA, our commission and the Ken Gardner Policy Institute submitted a second grant proposal to the Walmart Foundation for a second round of research that would dovetail into the focus groups. We've got this focus groups that are doing a qualitative, but now they want to do an actual survey that would provide additional rigor to the research that we're doing on women's experiences in the workforce and being prepared for the workforce by using a survey instrument versus the focus group, so to complement the focus group. And they submitted that, and I want to thank Anne for her help, and we've got Erin Jennison here also with the YWCA that kept us going to try to get that application submitted, and very happy for their help. Commissioner Bonas has told me that we can move forward with utilizing our funding, so we're going to have the research committee begin exploring the contracting with an individual to do the research related to post-secondary education. That the research subcommittee has brought to our attention as something that needs additional review and exploration. So hope that we'll have that moving forward sooner rather than later. And I think that's it, unless anybody else has additional information that they would like to share with the commission on committee work. Alrighty. A couple of other things that we need to get to, but I think what I'd like to do is refer to our next commission meeting, as we do need, we do have one position for commissioner to represent a company or an organization of 500 or more employees. We still need to find that individual to recruit. So if you have ideas, please let either Representative Edwards or myself know of any ideas of organizations that we might want to reach out to, see if they have an individual in upper management that would be great to be on our board or our commission to represent that vacancy. And then we need to schedule our next meeting. One thing that I wanted to propose to the commission is we've been using the doodle polls over the past couple of years to try to find a time that works for everyone. I think what I'd like to do is see, and I haven't talked to anyone about this, I apologize, but I think what we need to do is say the commission meets the third Tuesday of every month, or we meet the second Wednesday of every month, and if people can make it, people can make it. I'll throw out a couple of we'll do one more doodle poll, but it'll be more of a sort of a date. You know, we're thinking of second Tuesday, third Tuesday, you know, we'll go through each week and let's just see where people are at and where we see a consensus as close as we can. We'll just start doing that because it's just, poor Shelley, she's trying to get around her tax, and particularly with the chairs, and trying to find a time that works. And I think if we just said, this is when we meet on this date every month, then we're not scrambling after each other. And then we also know when we're planning other things in our lives that we have a Women in the Economy Commission on this set date and time every month. So we'll look at doing that. So Shelley and I can work on that. Okay. We'll do that. We'll try to do that for October. So throughout a few, usually the third week of the month is really bad for us as Paris is a legislative intern, but maybe the second week of the month and the fourth week of the month we can look and see if there are a couple of days that work for people. Commissioner Barnett?
Thank you for doing that.
I'm quite sure I didn't put down that I would come today. Yes, I am.
I'm glad you're here.
I picked up my granddaughter from school, but my daughter's meeting was canceled, so I said I wouldn't be here, then I'd be here, and I thought, I know I didn't put that on the doodle poll, but please, that would be wonderful if we could do that.
Our minds are a bit better for both.
Yes, right.
Okay.
All
right. For you.
So after 9, yes. Okay. On March. Okay, so like in my review, we're doing, okay, we should go look at a couple of dates.
And then we can go once, maybe not monthly during the session.
Okay.
Right, so maybe in the monthly, and while you guys have some time, and then there's a session maybe we have kind of a...
And actually, I think according to our bill, we're only supposed to, no, I think we're only supposed to meet 6 months, a minimum of 6 months a year. So we, that's why our... What, but when is supposed to be during the session? Right. So we'll probably do it in February. Well, then we'll make it work. So, and that might be one where we would meet at 10 o'clock because we have some meetings. But for all intents and purposes, we'll try to come up with a consistent date.
Like every other month?
Yeah, that's, yeah, and that's what I'm thinking.
Wow.
Yeah, so we'll figure it out. Thanks, everyone. Thanks, commissioners. I'm going to go ahead and adjourn the meeting.